Welcome to AgriPulse Newsmakers, where we aim to take you to the heart of ag policy. I'm Spencer Chase. This week's show features more exclusive interviews from the National Association of Farm Broadcasting's 80th Annual Convention in Kansas City, Missouri. The fertilizer industry has seen its fair share of volatility in recent years. The COVID-19 pandemic disrupted global supply chains, limiting availability of key inputs for producers and sending prices of available supplies higher. Then, Russia's invasion of Ukraine in early 2022 led to new trade restrictions. According to USDA figures, prices increased more than 50% from February to April of that year. Now, low water levels along the Mississippi River could threaten the transportation of fertilizer and other inputs headed into the 2024 growing season. The Biden administration has taken steps to bolster domestic fertilizer production, but many industry analysts say the $500 million investment will only go so far. Corey Rosenbusch is the leader of the Fertilizer Institute. We started our conversation by asking him what he's heard in recent conversations with industry economists and what he thinks that means for the short and long term.
We had our economics committee meeting, so many of the fertilizer member companies, economists, were there. And I think generally speaking, we came off of extreme volatility, and I think everyone is looking for some stability. We saw softening in the market early in 2023. Some retailers weathered that well. It was a soft landing. Others had to have, you know, some pretty major write-offs in inventory from that higher priced product they had bought. But stability benefits everyone. It helps the grower, but it also helps, you know, fertilizer distributors, manufacturers as well. I think looking forward, I was talking to one individual who said they had the strongest anhydrous ammonia season ever this year, this fall. And they're expecting a strong spring as well. Most of them ran their inventories to zero. They wanted to get rid of all of that product to reset going into this next growing season. So that's happening. And at a very high level, grain stock to use ratios on a global basis are still very tight. And with stable crop prices, I think everyone is expecting strong demand going into the spring. I think any expectation that we're gonna go back to 2018 or 19, which were record low prices, one is not sustainable, but we're just never gonna get, well, I don't wanna say never, we're at least not currently gonna get there. So hopefully we'll have some stability going forward. And, you know, God willing, there's no major additional wars. We're watching very closely what's going on in Israel right now because they're a pretty major fertilizer supplier.
Mm-hmm. Looking then at the 24 growing season and looking at producer demand for fertilizer products during that season, any concerns about any particular inputs that they're going to be looking at, maybe not being able to get their hands on enough?
No, I think everyone felt pretty confident about supply. I think there's still a lot of talk about potash. And, you know, as we know in the United States, 93% of that gets imported. Fortunately, 85% of that comes from Canada. So we have a friendly nation. But 40% of global potash supply is in Belarus and Russia. So most of those trade flows have now kind of sorted themselves out. On the nitrogen front, I think everyone was really watching what China does. When India came out with their tender, there was some plans to supply that from China, but then that got halted. China officially says they're not putting forward any export quotas, yet there seem to be some vessels that aren't moving the way they expected to. And so I think everyone's just watching that from a urea standpoint. But generally speaking, I think people feel confident about supply. It really comes down to the other topic that we discussed, which is transportation. What's going to happen in the river? Are things going to get forward positioning where they need to be for the spring?
Mm-hmm. Well, and let's talk about that too, because obviously a lot of the barge traffic going down, taking grain down, taking fertilizer back up. Is the product going to be able to get there in time? You know, the company might have the inventory that exists somewhere in the world. Are they going to have it in the right elevators?
I would say for the most part, everyone plans well in advance because of that situation. What's difficult is if growers are not planning in advance with their ag retail partners so those pre-purchases can be made and positioned, that kind of just-in-time, last-minute spot market is where we run into issues.
We'll be right back with more from Rosenbusch right after this.
Farmers are always there for each other. We shed tears together. We celebrate together. But we also grow together. Farm Bureau is the largest general farm organization in the country. We have the farmers' back. If you're a farmer and you're not a member, we would welcome you into our Farm Bureau family. And if you want to know more about agriculture, come be part of this great family.
Regenerative poultry production is a process by which nature can actually recapture and restore the energy that is being taken out of a space.
Farm Credit helped Rahe build his dream of regenerative poultry farming and encouraging fellow immigrants to find community in agriculture.
Nothing beats a farm. I'm just pursuing happiness.
Learn more at farmcredit.com/beginning.
Welcome back. The Biden administration recently took action to slash tariff rates on imported Moroccan phosphate. While the lower duty could be good news for American producers, TFI's Corey Rosenbusch says the situation is complex.
This summer, there were two court cases that were the appeal of the Court of International Trade that got remanded, one to Commerce to do a recalculation of Moroccan phosphate, the other to the ITC, the International Trade Commission, to reconsider the case and some of the facts that they used in specifically 2019 when the Mississippi River was flooded with imports. So set those aside. The two things you probably recently saw in the news were unrelated to those two cases. It was one, just the annual administrative review of phosphates. And I think the headline was the Moroccan duty coming down to 2%. And then the other was a response to another appeal that the court had sent back to Commerce in relation to some ownership of natural gas companies in Russia. And so they responded back to the court as it related to that case. So there were actually three remands that came from the Court of International Trade. And then, of course, the other was the annual review. Now, Commerce is going to have to do additional calculations because one of those remand directed them to look at overhead costs in the calculation for specifically Moroccan phosphate.
Well, and on the Moroccan phosphate front, I have to imagine that if those tariff rates are coming down to such a substantial level, there has to be some kind of broader impact on the world market and the American market in particular.
Yeah, so I think the thing that we have to think about are trade flows. A lot of that product that was coming from Morocco got replaced with Saudi, even some Australian phosphate that was coming into the U.S. Will the market dictate those trade flows to shift again because some of that Moroccan phosphate found a home in Brazil, for example? And so that's really the question we'll all be watching is, will those trade flow patterns shift again if those duties are lowered or eventually replaced or removed.
Mm-hmm. Looking again at the domestic market, domestic production in particular, we've seen the Biden administration take some interest in bolstering domestic fertilizer production here in the United mm-hmm. States, but those are projects that are I believe $500 million is their funding level. What kind of a dent can that amount of investment make in the issue?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'll start with a high level and say one of the things that we learned during the market volatility we experienced was that 90% of all fertilizers consumed outside of the United States. We are a net importer of fertilizer in the United States. So while we still need strong policy for importing fertilizer to supply the farmer, we also need strong domestic policy. We really appreciate what USDA has done in investing in some fertilizer technologies. And I think that's probably the best way to categorize what a lot of those projects are. When you think about an anhydrous ammonia plant that would cost billions to build, $500 million isn't going to necessarily grow supply of nitrogen fertilizers. And one of the things that we've been advocating for and really getting Congress, but also USDA to focus on are things like permitting. So phosphate, potash, they're put on this planet where God put them. And fortunately, we didn't get a large of quantity here in the United States, but we do have reserves that we can take advantage of to increase domestic supply so that when we do have geopolitical events, we don't see the same level of disruption. Our obstacle is permitting reform. One phosphate company recently got their permit, but it took 10 years and $32 million. You can't just turn on the spigot and more phosphate comes out. And we need good solid policy to help facilitate that as well.
Mm-hmm. One of the first conversations you and I had when you got the new gig here at TFI was talking about things like biostimulants, yeah. things like other innovations besides some of the traditional N, P, and K fertilizer that folks might be very familiar with and use on their producer, on their farms on a regular basis. Where is the industry at in terms of bringing some of those innovations from the research phase into the go-to-market phase where we might see them on farms across the country?
One of my favorite questions I always get is, well, why would the fertilizer industry support these technologies? Doesn't that eat into demand for fertilizer? And the opposite is true. We're responsible for 50% of global food yields or global crop yields. So demand's going to continue to grow, and we need these technologies in order to be more efficient, in order to be more sustainable. And you'll see a lot of fertilizer manufacturers and distributors investing in these technologies. Specifically on the biostimulant front, we're real excited that we released our biostimulant certification. As I was visiting with retailers, one of the key themes that I heard was that they have hundreds of new products coming across their desk, and they just don't know where to begin to evaluate them. So we developed a standard, which is a baseline for efficacy, composition, and safety. And if a manufacturer of a biostimulant can meet that standard, they get a certification, and that will at least cue agronomists, crop advisors, growers to know where to start in selecting what they're going to use in their own field trials. So we're seeing an explosion in those products, and we just need to make sure we have a pathway to market that farmers can use them.
Corey, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
We'll be right back to take a look at the state of the river system for American agriculture. But first, our Hannah Pagel introduces us to a new member of the House Ag Committee.
Congressman Max Miller represents Ohio's 7th District and is new to the agriculture industry. While he was running for Congress, Miller used this knowledge gap as an opportunity to meet with his potential constituents and learn more about their challenges.
And I looked at him and I said, you know, I didn't grow up on a farm, but I need you. And I need you as partners to help educate me so I can be the best champion for you in Congress. And I believe that resonated.
Aside from the House Ag Committee, Miller is also on the House Science, Space, and Technology Committee, where he chairs the Environment Subcommittee. Congressman Miller is also one of two Jewish House Republicans, and he shared with us his thoughts on the long-running conflict between Israel and Hamas in his Meet the Lawmaker interview, which you can watch on AgriPulse.com. For AgriPulse Newsmakers, I'm Hannah Pagel.
Did you know AgriPulse has all your favorite podcasts, including Open Mic, Newsmakers, and Drive Time? Take us wherever you go. Subscribe at AgriPulse.com or on Spotify, Google Play, or Apple Podcasts.
Agriculture Future of America is a nonprofit building transformational leaders in food and agriculture. AFA prepares college students to join the workforce as innovative and engaged young professionals who will shape the future of agriculture. Head to agfuture.org to find out how you can get involved.
The Senate and House Ag Committees are busy working on the next Farm Bill, which will cover commodities, specialty crops, livestock, and more. This legislation will impact every farmer, rancher, and rural business for the next 5 years. Make sure you don't miss insights and analytics that only AgriPulse and its top-notch team of well-connected experts can provide. Register today for a free trial at agripulse.com and click the subscribe button, or email us at pam@agri-pulse.com. You don't want to miss this Farm Bill coverage.
Welcome back. Barge traffic on the Mississippi River has been impacted in recent years by low water levels, slowing the flow of crops down the river and key inputs on return trips back north. Mike Steenhoek with the Soy Transportation Coalition says the critical path for agricultural exports has been curtailed.
It's really unfortunate. At a really inopportune time, we have this very important maritime highway called the Mississippi River that's not operating at full capacity. So it's kind of analogous from going from a four-lane highway down to two lanes. Barge transportation is still occurring. We're still exporting out of the Mississippi Gulf region. That still will remain our number one export region for soybeans and for corn. But unfortunately, it's not as efficient as it normally is. With less precipitation, you have lower water levels on the river itself, you have a narrower shipping channel, and so that impacts barge transportation in two ways, due to channel depth and channel width. You can't put as many soybeans in each barge, and so we're seeing a light loading of about a 25% reduction of the individual barges, And then you're not able to put as many barges together to form one single unit due to channel width being more narrow.
What is this ultimately having by way of an impact on producers?
Well, producers are having to explore options B, C, and D. Now, some producers don't really have an effective option B. They may normally just send their soybeans or their grain to the river because it normally is a real compelling option for them. So they haven't maybe built as much on-farm storage, or they don't have access to a rail loading facility. So those farmers who don't have those options, they're more exposed, and the problems will be more severe. Now, for other farmers, it may result in an additional cost and some additional inconvenience to maybe drive, say, 100 miles to get to a soybean crush facility or to a rail loading facility that might send those soybeans to a place like Mexico. So it really is going to depend on each individual farmer. Mm-hmm.
The 2021 infrastructure bill, now about 2 years old, wondering, you know, obviously infrastructure projects take a long time to be built and for the benefits to be materialized, but 2 years in, how is that legislation and the investments that it made working in rural America?
Yeah, you know, one of my indictments that I would often make about the United States is that we're a spending nation, not an investing nation, and there's a big difference between the two. And we were really pleased to see the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act get passed in November of 2021. We are continuing to see meaningful investments being made in things like the inland waterway system with locks and dams. A lot of our port projects that are very important to us, we're seeing some of that funding get allocated to some of these meaningful projects. We just had one recently that received $9.3 million on the Great Lakes system. That was something that was a priority for us. So we are seeing that investment, and that certainly is good news, and we appreciate that. Now, the challenge that we've seen is that with that additional revenue that we're experiencing and enjoying, we're seeing accompanying that infrastructure inflation, and that's occurring for a variety of reasons. But now, you know, the cost of building anything is substantially higher than it historically has been. Overall, we still remain very supportive and appreciative of the fact that bill did get signed into law.
So that bill get signed into law, obviously it was a mammoth undertaking to get it moved. What more does Congress need to do on this front?
One of the things that I think we certainly need to do a better job of is not just focusing on the revenue side of the equation, as if all of our infrastructure problems can get solved by government writing a bigger check. There is a lot of improvement to be made, and this is where government doesn't do a very good job of really making the taxpayer dollar stretch further to get more bang for the buck. And that's something that you see a lot of the things that we do at the Soy Transportation Coalition is really asking the question, how can we do more with less? Because, you know, while again, we're very appreciative that we have additional resources being deployed for these infrastructure projects, my crystal ball suggests that there will be a time where we have a reckoning with our increasing levels of debt, and we're not going to be able to make these kind of investments unless we make some really hard decisions. So then we need to be a better steward of taxpayer dollars and you know, really making sure that, you know, we really enhance that as well.
Mike, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
We'll be right back with an update on how the rail industry is impacting producers right after this.
Farmers are always there for each other. We shed tears together. We celebrate together. But we also grow together. Farm Bureau is the largest general farm organization in the country. We have the farmers' back. If you're a farmer and you're not a member, we would welcome you into our Farm Bureau family. And if you want to know more about agriculture, come be part of this great family.
Looking closer, seeing further. That's how we do it. At Curious Plot, we're driven to find what's next for agriculture, animal care, and food. We stay curious because that's what it takes to grow understanding. That's how we plot strategies and tell stories that get results time after time. Marketing, communications, and consulting that look closer and see further. Curious Plot. We can't wait to help you tell your story.
Welcome back. With the 2023 harvest hitting the rails, Mike Seifert with the National Grain and Feed Association says the state of rail service has improved.
I think we're in a lot better spot than we were 12, particularly 18 months ago. That was well publicized, the challenges that we were having. And what we're seeing, what we're hearing from our membership, there are still pockets where there may be some challenges, where there may be some crew issues, but overall things are moving much better. When you look at the metrics just on grain cars, when you look at cars that are filled and waiting to move, when you look at unfilled orders, when you look at dwell time at origin, all have dropped considerably, and that's the direction you want them to go in the last year and a half. And so obviously freight on the system as a whole is down. We're moving some less grain as well because exports are down.
The areas where issues have existed, you know, you said we're in a better place now, but the places where those issues existed, is there a geographic footprint? Is it a company issue? Where were those issues?
It was kind of all over the board. It really was. I would say at least four of the six class ones were having some pretty specific issues in different areas, but it wasn't necessarily, for some it was clear across the whole system, but others it was specific pockets. What I would say now is what we were hearing more from the class ones, if they're having challenges in areas, a lot of it has come to either if they've had some technical issues, one of the class ones had some computer and dispatch issues back earlier in the fall, or they've just had in some areas some challenges still hiring in crews. And you know, a lot of those places, if we were able to list them, I think you'd probably hear and be able to match up and say, well, these are the same places we've heard other sectors of the serving agriculture having trouble hiring.
Mm-hmm. Let's wrap up talking about the Surface Transportation Board. I know that's a body that NGFA and other groups have gone before quite a bit over the course of the last couple of years, but a little quieter relationship with that body these days. Where do things stand between agriculture and the Surface Transportation Board?
Well, I think we have a very good relationship. And I think STB and the board members and Chairman Overman in particular have been very open to working with us, listening to the concerns of the shippers and the receivers. And you know, STB just put out a reciprocal switching proposal, which is in the comment period. The comment period is closed. They're now reviewing it. We do think some of the data information that it would provide and that would require would be very helpful to shippers and receivers. We do think and have encouraged them to take some additional action in terms of looking at competitiveness issues and also putting in place what would be called reciprocal demurrage on private rail cars. That's another proceeding that they've had going on. But I do want to say we've got a great relationship with them, but I think I always point out to folks that the railroads are also members of National Grain and Feed Association. And one thing that we've really worked on in the last year and a half, and they've worked with us, is to improve the communication between the class ones and the railroads and NGFA and our other members. And I think for some issues, some discussions that we maybe would have gone to STB, say a year and a half ago, now we're able to have those conversations directly with the class ones and kind of work those out on behalf of our membership on both sides as well. And so I think that's been a very good relationship.
Mike, thanks for joining us.
You bet, thank you.
We'll be right back with more AgriPulse Newsmakers, but first, our Quentin Slater walks us through the market for a fall favorite in this week's Ag by the Numbers.
If you've seen or tasted a pumpkin this fall, there's a good chance farmland in one of these states had something to do with it. A small number of states account for about 40% of all pumpkins harvested in the country. This chart shows the top six pumpkin-producing states from 2020 to 2022. The six states together combined for about 1.2 billion pounds of pumpkins harvested in 2022. Illinois alone harvested about half that total. Illinois is at the top of the list for pumpkin production and yield. The land of Lincoln produced about 630 million pounds of pumpkin in 2022. Indiana was the next most productive state at 160 million pounds, followed by California at 120 million, Michigan and Pennsylvania both at about 90 million, and Virginia rounding out the major states with 50 million pounds of production. Most pumpkins grown in the U.S. are used for decoration, but many, including about 80% of the crop from Illinois, are processed into food products like puree. For AgriPulse, I'm Quentin Slater.
It's not as simple just to wake up one day and go, I want to be a conservation farmer. You're changing how your farming practice is done. You're changing your operation.
Farm Credit supported John and Kelly Watley as they shifted to more sustainable farming, improving the environment where they farm and live. Learn more at farmcredit.com/climate.
The Senate and House Ag Committees are busy working on the next Farm Bill, which will cover commodities, specialty crops, livestock, and more. This legislation will impact every farmer, rancher, and rural business for the next 5 years. Make sure you don't miss insights and analytics that only AgriPulse and its top-notch team of well-connected experts can provide. Register today for a free trial at agripulse.com and click the subscribe button, or email us at pam@agri-pulse.com. You don't want to miss this Farm Bill coverage.
Thanks again for tuning in for another episode of AgriPulse Newsmakers, and we hope you're having a great Thanksgiving weekend with friends and family. Here's what's on the horizon for the upcoming week. Members of the Association of Equipment Manufacturers and the Ag Retailers Association will be getting together for their annual conferences. USDA will release its monthly report on agricultural prices Thursday, and we'll keep an eye on all of that and more with our coverage on AgriPulse.com. For AgriPulse Newsmakers, I'm Spencer Chase. Have a good one. Newsmakers is a production of AgriPulse Communications. For more ag policy news, visit agripulse.com. You can also find our new content on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to follow AgriPulse and our correspondents on social media to get breaking news and more.